I don't believe that we can necessarily convince racists through reason or through shame. I think we have to crush them politically.
Being woke too often these days is just a matter of turning and doing high fives with people who think like you and not being concerned with doing the work and thinking about what really helps people.
We continue to have a society that is divided and unequal in racial terms. And those inherited racial inequalities do come from a deep past that we have never properly reckoned with in public policy or in our public history.
Virtue signaling now stands in for being politically concerned. A person who in 1965 would have said, "What can I do to help?" is now asking, "How can I show that I'm a moral person?" But that's more Martin Luther than Martin Luther King. I just made that up just now. There.
Welcome to this third debate, of the third season of the Soho Forum at the Subculture Theater in downtown Manhattan. I'm Gene Epstein, director of the Soho Forum. Tonight's resolution reads, "The message of anti-racism has become as harmful a force in American life as racism itself." We do Oxford-style voting, as most of you know. The initial vote is the baseline, and whoever moves the vote in his or her favor technically wins the debate. While you're thinking about that resolution, I just want to thank those of you who attended our big gala, Socialism Debate, at the John Jay Theater. We did get nearly 500 people to show up, many of them socialists, and so we were very pleased by that. We needed, in other words, a much larger place to accommodate that crowd. It was a debate that I participated in, taking the negative. Technically, I did win, and I want to thank all of you who complimented me on how it went. It's been 21 days since the Reason released the YouTube video, and we've had 28,000 views of that video, which is the second highest we've ever had. The third highest was 16,000 in our debate in education. The first is our absolute outlier. The highest of all was 355,000 views for a Bitcoin debate. Bitcoin debates clearly attract a lot of people. But we certainly did well on our socialism debate. I had four separate invitations to appear on podcasts to be interviewed about the debate. For those of you who haven't seen it, I did make the novel argument that socialists do not have to abolish capitalism in order to achieve a socialist economy. It's actually quite a pedestrian argument, obvious enough, but rather novel, certainly from the standpoint of my debating opponent, Bhaskar Sankara. I do want to take to heart two criticisms that I received about the way the debate went. On the one hand, a few days after I did the debate, I went to a conference, and a bunch of young guys surrounded me. They'd been there, and they told me, "You were on fire. You killed it. You crushed it." I almost felt sorry for the guy. And that was good to hear, but then I did say, guys, it's probably a mistake to make people feel sorry for your debating opponent. Maybe I was a little bit too much on fire and killed it a little bit too much. And so I do take to heart those critics who said, "You lost it a little bit." I guarantee you that I wasn't doing this in any tactical or conscious way. I think in a way I was hectoring my younger self when I started yelling at Bhaskar Sankara that he should read up on economics and possibly appreciate the point that he can make the revolution right now. But I promise you that I'll try to do better the next time and recognize that it doesn't pay to lose it to some degree, as I did. The other criticism was that maybe I was stepping into the debating ring, so to speak, with a lightweight. He's only 29. I mean, he is indeed the editor-in-chief of Jacobin Magazine. He's got a book contract with Basic Books, a very prestigious label. He is going places. But I'm now in talks with a guy named Richard Wolff, who's in his 70s, an emeritus professor at UMass, publisher of many books on the importance of socialism, and possibly next October, only every October will we do outreach to socialists, I'm going to have another debate on socialism with, in this case, Richard Wolff. I also want to announce that what you see also on your chair is the 50th anniversary edition of Reason Magazine. I've read it cover to cover. It really is a delight and a collector's item. If Nick Gillespie's in the house. Nick, do you want to come to the stage for a moment and talk about it, or are you not in the mood? Nick? Nick would rather not. You're welcome. Okay, take a copy and read it. Nick has a fun article in it about the Whole Earth catalog. Some of you are old enough to remember it. I certainly am. Published at the same time that Reason was. It's got a rollicking article about Lanny Friedlander, the slightly loony guy who started Reason 50 years ago. And somebody brought me up short recently and said, well, why else is it called Reason? It's called Reason because it was created by an objectivist, an Ayn Randian, as in indeed it was. It's gone a bit eclectic since then in terms of the Ayn Rand enthusiasts, but Lanny Friedlander definitely did call it Reason in the spirit of Ayn Rand. Anyway, I do recommend that you take it home, and once you finish it, give it to your socialist friends to read as well. Now, at all SOA forums, we do want to have our warm-up act. That is Dave Smith, who puts out the show Part of the Problem. Dave, I hope you're in the audience, and I hope you can come to the stage to teach us how not to be part of the problem.
Oh, thank you, Gene. What's up? How is everybody? We're back at the Soho Forum without all those commie bastards. This is, that was fun, but, you know, I'm over it at this point. If any of you people heckle me, I'm fist fighting you outside after this. That was a fun one. Congratulations, Gene, on your dominant performance. Welcome back, Jane, everybody, who just had a baby, is back with us today. So congrats. Yeah, clap, you animals. Get a baby. I'm really just saying it because my wife is 8.5 months pregnant, and I want you guys to clap for me when I come back after that. But yeah, she could go anytime now. But I, as I told people in the back, if she calls me and says my water just broke, I'm not leaving the debate. I'm just like, sorry, this isn't a good time for me. So I don't know what to tell you. It is hard. It's hard being like married when your wife's pregnant. It's like a weird time because it's so much that they go through and you're just kind of there, you know, right, Jane? Like it's like, it's kind of like you're like a Yankee fan and she's Derek Jeter and you're just the person who did this to Derek Jeter, and every now and then you're like, can I get you another pillow, Derek Jeter? And then you're like, why is Derek Jeter furious at me right now? I don't know. But anyway, it's all right, sorry, the topic at hand, racism. Personally, I'm against it, but let's have the debate and see what happens. I don't know. I'm against racism because, you know, I'm a Jew. And, of course, I don't want anyone to hate blacks because if you hate black people, you also hate Jews. Those are the rules, all right? There's never been anybody who hated black people and didn't also hate Jews. Like, there's never, like, a guy who's like, you know, the problem is these blacks. And you're like, what do you think of the Jews? And they're like, good people. Nothing against that. Like, we're always dragged into that shit, too. So, just for self, you know. I don't think racism is really that big of a problem today. I mean, I have it on good authority that Donald Trump is going to do tremendously great things for the black community. So, yeah. Donald Trump said that himself. So, you know it's true. If you can, did you hear Donald Trump said, and this is a direct quote, he said that in his reelection campaign in 2020, he is going to carry 95% of the black vote. It was actually the most modest thing Donald Trump has ever said. he acknowledged 5% might still go the other way, but do you remember back in 2016 when Donald Trump said his pitch to the black voters was, what do you have to lose? Do you remember that? When he was just like, you're living in squalor, like, what do you have to lose? Vote Trump. That was the greatest pitch I've ever heard in my life, a politician. My white liberal friends were so outraged. Like, they were like, that is the most racist thing ever. They have nothing to lose. And then I talked to one of my black friends, and he was like, makes a pretty good point. And I was like, you know what? This shit might work, after all. I don't know. Racism isn't good. Sometimes it works out. This is like 10 years ago, and I was in Toronto with another friend of mine, a comedian, and we were on traveling, doing shows in Toronto. And, you know, I was young. I was in my 20s. And so was he. And he was like, hey, you know what would be fun on this trip is if we got some weed. And I was like, I agree, sir, because we spoke proper English back then. And he was like, we should try to find some weed. And then my friend Justin, he was like, I'm going to ask that big black bouncer outside the strip club if he knows where we can get weed. And I was like, whoa, dude, that's a little racist. But in Justin's defense, not only did that guy know, he was selling weed. So we ended up buying weed from that guy. Worked out well that time. I'm just saying, it wasn't cool, but it did work out pretty effectively at that point. My friend Justin just like charged right up to him, and I was like, I don't think we should do this. And he was like, hey, bro. And I was like, don't call him bro. Like, what? And he was like, you know where I can get some weed? And he was like, big black dude, you know, bouncer. And he goes, are you guys cops? And I was like, no, we're not cops. We're comedians. We're performing down the street. And then he just like, I didn't say it. He goes, are you guys cops? And I was like, no, I just said we're not cops. And he goes, you guys are cops, right? And I was like, we should just leave. This isn't going to work out well. And then I said no one more time. And then he just pulled out a huge bag of weed in the middle of the street, the middle of the Toronto street. And I was like, I guess three times is the charm. Now that's all like... Like, if we were real cops, the third time would have got us, you know? Like, you cops? No, no. And they're like, you're cops? You're like, you got me, I'm a cop. All right, get out of here. But anyway, wherever that guy is in the world, thanks for getting me weed 10 years ago. Appreciate that. So I do, you know, I wouldn't call myself an expert in black culture, but I got a haircut at a black barbershop once in my life. It was an accident, but it happened. And another story, this is the life of a comedian. I was always on the road, and I was in, like, I don't even remember where. I think it was Memphis or something, but I needed a haircut, and there was just a sign that said barbershop, and I didn't know what it was. It was, like, in this mall, and I walked in, and then I realized it was a black barbershop, like, as I got in there, but it was too late because I was already there, and there was, like, this big... jacked up black dude wearing a wife beater and like a huge gold chain. And I walked in, and the conversation that I interrupted, he was talking to a friend of his, and he was like, so I told that motherfucker, I'll kill you. And then he looked over and he was like, can I help you? And I was like, oh man, what did I just get myself into? And I was like, I think I'm just gonna take off. And then he just like black guy bullied me into getting a haircut. He was like, sit down, motherfucker. I was like, okay, I'll sit down, no problem. And I sat down, and he was like, so what do you want? And, you know, I was like, I don't know, just take a little off the top. And then he said the most terrifying words that my white ears have ever heard in my life before a haircut, which is, he goes, so you want like a scissor haircut? And I was like, this isn't gonna work out well. And it did not work out well at all. He pulled out a pair of scissors that looked like they came with the barbershop when they opened the barbershop. Like, no one's ever used these here before. And he was like, it was like he was just guessing. Like, you're just like, I don't know, I'm gonna cut this off. And I was like, thank you. And I left. But that's all I got. That's my experience with black culture. I'm sorry. No, I'm just kidding. I grew up in Brooklyn. There's every race of culture. That's what racism never even seemed like a real thing to me. But I guess it is a real thing. Like, every now and then, that's like the thing. Like, you learn is like, because I'm a Jewish kid from Brooklyn, so it's not like people are really, like, it's all just like a joke to me, the idea of like open bigotry. But then when I started going throughout the country, you're like, oh, there's a little bit of it out there. Like, I used to always think it was crazy. It was just something left-wing people made up. Like, there's no racism in this country. And then it's been brought up to the surface a little bit in the last few years, you know? Like the left-wing people would always call, like, Trump supporters Nazis. So you're like, there's no Nazis, you know? And then they had that Charlottesville thing. And I was like, there might be a few. Like, there might be a couple of them out there. I don't know. Like, they're not Nazis, they're just conservatives, you know? And he's like, that guy's got a swastika tattoo on his neck. And you're like, okay, he's on the edge. Like, that guy might be a little bit. But I still just laugh at it. I don't know why. I just laugh at, like, even in the Charlottesville thing, when they were chanting, the Jews will not replace us. At, like, I'm a Jew. That was the most empowered I've ever felt as a Jewish person in my entire life. And they're out there like, the Jews will not replace us. Like, look, I have never, in my wildest Jew fantasies, entertained the idea of replacing anybody. We simply don't have the numbers. But then you saw all these fucking angry tiki torch guys, and they're like, the Jews will not replace us. And I was like, you know what? I think we can replace these motherfuckers. Like, I think we can do this. We just get our act together. Let's strike now, Jews. All right, you guys are great. Enjoy the debate, everybody. Thank you for having me. Thank you, Gene.
Dave Smith, and you should listen to his Part of the Problem podcast. He's terrific. Well, now for the main event. Remember, the resolution reads, the message of anti-racism has become as harmful a force in American life as racism itself. Here to speak for the affirmative, Columbia University Professor John McWhorter. John, please come to the stage. And speaking for the negative, NYU Professor Nikhil Singh. Nikhil, please come to the stage. Jane, please close the voting. It's all closed? Okay. John, please take the podium and speak for the affirmative. Thank you.
Let's talk about the cops. This is very important. I think when we discuss racism in America and whether it exists and to what extent and how important it is, the first thing on a lot of our minds is racism from the police. And so I think we need to talk about that first. And there's some things that I don't think we always know. Tamir Rice was a black boy of about 12 who was brandishing a toy weapon, and he was shot dead. The exact same thing happened to a boy named Daniel Shaver not long after that. Daniel Shaver was white. Sam DuBose was shot dead by the police driving his car away from a cop. The exact same thing happened, actually a little bit before that, to a white guy named Andrew Thomas. Alton Sterling was a black man who reached into his waistband and reached for his wallet during an altercation with the cops, and the cops shot him dead. That was a grievous event. And the same thing actually happened around the same time to a white guy named Dylan Noble. Alton Sterling made national headlines. None of us heard about Dylan Noble. George Zimmerman said some really nasty things about unspecified little people and how they're always going around stealing things before he ended up killing Trayvon Martin. Now, that was a terrible thing, especially because a policeman said the same sorts of things, including using the word fucker, before he killed a white teenager named Lauren Simpson. I could do this for 20 minutes. There is a very understandable tendency in the media to report stories of black people unjustly killed by the police. Whereas what we don't know is that for every one of those events, there is a white teenager or 20-something who is killed under almost ominously similar conditions where you've really got to dig to find it out. Now, I'm not saying that there's fake news or some grand conspiracy. I understand why the media are so concerned with the black cases. But I'm bringing this up because I think that generally we are often told that any conversation about race is shut down by the purported racist tendencies of cops who, in a hair trigger situation, will allow their quiet bias to kill a black guy when, if it were a white guy, he would get away with a slap on the hand. That's a very reasonable assumption. But, you know, that really hasn't held up to scrutiny, and it's why I allowed myself to do this particular debate with this particular question. Even the numbers are quite different from what we hear. And so, for example, there is the issue of proportion. So, white men, 62% of the male population, they are half of the people who get killed by cops. Black men, 13%, and they are a quarter of the people who are killed by cops. And so it's disproportionate. So one might think, well, that means that still there is a racist bias against black men because so many more of them are killed proportionately. But no, not really. There's a debate team trick that's going on in relation to that. Because it wasn't so long ago that when we talked about welfare, disproportionate amount of black people were on welfare, but more white people were on welfare numerically. So if anybody pointed out that a disproportionate number of black people were on welfare, it was always pointed out by a certain crowd that no, actually, many more white people are on welfare, and that was considered a smackdown comment. Well, we're in the same sort of situation. Or it was often said, if you kept asking questions, the reason there's a disproportionate number of black people on welfare is because poverty affects black people disproportionately because of structural racism. That was reasonable. Well, we also know that poverty makes it more likely for somebody to encounter a policeman in these sorts of situations. Poverty caused by structural racism, therefore, might certainly make it so that there are more black men killed by the police. And that means that we have to question the idea that what this is all about is underlying pernicious biases of the cops. I almost can't believe I'm saying this because I spent a very long time thinking what a lot of people think about the cops. I have a reputation for saying that racism is as important as people make it, but I always made an exception for the cops. And not too long ago, I had one of my blogging heads conversations with Glenn Lowry, where I told him, Glenn, you've got to give me figures if that's not true. And I didn't know that the figures actually exist. And so I had to really make an adjustment, really think in a new way about this kind of thing. What we're told about the cops simply isn't true. Therefore, when I say that anti-racism is as much a problem as a help at this point, I'm saying that after my conversion about the cops are not a smackdown issue in this debate. So, with that said, what's the issue here? Why in the world would I say that anti-racism is a problem? Because, of course, no, it's not a problem to not be a racist, and I don't think any of us would be here if we thought the debate was over that. So, of course, you don't want to be a racist. Racism is bad. We know that. But what about the more complex and therefore more interesting issues? And one issue is that anti-racism, as currently configured, has gone a long way from what used to be considered intelligent and sincere civil rights activism. Today, it's a religion, and I don't mean that as a rhetorical feint. I mean that it actually is what any naive anthropologist would recognize as a faith in people, many of whom don't think of themselves as religious, but Galileo would recognize them quite easily. And so, for example, the idea that the responsible white person is supposed to attest to their white privilege and realize that it can never go away and feel eternally guilty about it, that's original sin right there. The idea that there is going to be a day when America comes to terms with race, or that there could be. What does that even mean? What is the meaning of the coming to terms? What would that consist of? Who would come to them? What would the terms be? At what date would this be? The only reason that anybody says that is because it corresponds to our conception of Judgment Day, and it's equally abstract. When we use the word problematic, especially since about 2008 or 9, what we're really saying is blasphemous. It's really the exact same term. Or the suspension of disbelief that is a characteristic of religious faith. There's an extent to which logic is considered no longer to apply. That's how we talk about racism. And so suppose someone asked, why are we to focus on the occasional rogue cop who kills a black man, when 9 times out of 10, that black man is in much more danger of being killed by another black man in his neighborhood. Gosh, that's not pretty, but like many things that aren't pretty, it's also true. If you ask about it, well, you know you're not supposed to. Eyes roll, and you're given an answer that doesn't really completely make sense, and there's an etiquette that you're supposed to stop there. It's rather like certain questions that you ask a priest very gently, but you know that if you don't get a real answer, then you're just supposed to move on. That we're used to with being devoutly religious, that is the way racism is treated these days. It's a religion. And many of us might say, you know, after thinking about it, you might realize that even if you're somebody who looks on devout religious faith among, say, a Mormon or a fundamentalist as something peculiar, you read books by anthropologists exploring this frame of mind, even if you realize, it might even be pleasant to realize about yourself that you are religious just like them. If you wonder how a Mormon feels, to be an anti-racist today is to be ideologically a very, very similar person. You might own it. You might say, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this religion? This is certainly a better religion than many others I can think of. But there are problems with it. There are severe problems with it. It does some good things. It gets some good people elected. Certainly, it does some good things. But it does some bad things. And so, for example, if you're a good anti-racist, then you're thinking about the cops that kill black men in these scenes that we know about. But you're not supposed to think about the fact that so much more murder happens to men like that in their own neighborhoods. You're supposed to think of that as maybe connected to racism in some abstract way, but you're not supposed to think about it. You're not supposed to think about all of those homicides. Every summer in big cities across America, teenage black boys are killing one another in the hundreds over frankly nothing. That's somehow less important than what the occasional rogue cop does. That's modern anti-racism for you. That's backwards. Another example, education. To be an anti-racist is to pay attention to the idea that universities must foster diversity. The idea being that supposedly universities wouldn't want to foster this diversity if they weren't made to do so. Now, what that means is that often this diversity is fostered as the result of creating a different evaluation system for black and often Latino students in terms of grades and test scores. Now, there are various studies that show that that often is not the best thing. And so Stephen Cole and Eleanor Barber did a paper where, contrary to their expectations, it showed that when students are mismatched to a university, it discourages them from getting PhDs. There have been many studies of that kind, but we're told to look away from them. So after racial preferences were banned in the University of California, before they were banned at the University of California, San Diego, in a freshman class of 3,268 students, of the freshman honors students, exactly one was black. In 1999, this is the first class admitted after the ban, when students were matched to a school according to their grades and test scores rather than there being the kind of bonus that we see, we're now seeing it at Harvard, 1 out of 5 black freshmen were making honors. Why have you never heard of that statistic? It's actually a beautiful story. These are black students who did very well, who wouldn't have done as well at Berkeley or UCLA. There's no tragedy. Those students are now out working and living wonderful lives. Anti-racism teaches us not to listen to stories like those. And when we think about anti-racism, we're taught to suppose, we start to not even think about this anymore, that whites need to undergo some sort of massive psychological revolution before we can have any kind of black success beyond what we have already. Why? Why is somebody talking about their white privilege important when we're talking about making black schools better? Why is it important for a Black Lives Matter activist to probe Hillary Clinton's heart as opposed to thinking about what policies she will take in terms of criminal sentencing or housing policy or the on-the-ground sorts of things that we really need to be thinking about if we want to help black people? I could go on here, too. There are a lot of things wrong with anti-racism. There are some good things, but there are just as many that are wrong that hold us back from helping black people who need help because we're taught to think of certain things rather than other things. In particular, we're taught to think less about the real work of helping people who need help on the ground through socio-political action. And instead, we end up thinking about inner psychology. We end up thinking about that which is problematic. And all of these things are ultimately idle. So this is what I mean by saying that anti-racism is a problem. Anti-racism as currently configured, not anti-racism just in itself, but modern anti-racism turns a blind eye to most black homicide. Anti-racism as currently configured turns a blind eye to black young people's upward mobility. It turns a blind eye to doing the kinds of things that civil rights leaders of 50 years ago considered ordinary in favor of what is ultimately an inwardly focused quest for moral absolution that has at best a diagonal relationship to helping people who've been left behind. For that reason, the issue here, I must repeat, is not whether or not racism exists. We know it does. Read the paper this morning, had some racism of my own 2 weeks ago. That's not the issue. The issue is whether modern anti-racism is the best way of combating the effects of that racism. And it isn't. Thank you.
Nikhil Singh for the negative. Take it away, Nikhil.
I was told that John is a formidable debater, and I am not going to be as capable of talking to you without notes. But I do want to remind you of the proposition before us, which is not exactly as it was just framed. The message of anti-racism has become as harmful a force in American life as racism itself. And that is the proposition I will speak to. And I want you to remember those four words, as harmful as racism itself. So the claim of anti-racism as harm here depends on how we assess the harm of racism and racial discrimination today. What I'll attempt to persuade you of in my time is, A, that racism remains a harmful force in our social, economic, and political life in ways that we actually can't just take for granted, and B, that the tangible harms of racism overwhelm any case that might be made for the annoyances or inconveniences produced by certain expressions of anti-racism. So I want to begin with a set of facts that I do not think are in dispute about racial disparity. John also spoke to issues of racial disparity in his comments, so I'm sure we'll come back to this. The United States in 2018 is characterized by racial disparities across every significant indicator of life chances: wealth, homeownership, rates of unemployment, poverty, arrest, and incarceration. In some cases, the statistical disparities are staggering. Black and Latino families have between 8 and 10 cents to every dollar of wealth owned by white families. Now, in an audience like this, I'm well aware that claiming evident disparity is not adequate and will not be taken as proof of racial discrimination. Three examples from well-respected researchers might begin to test this question. In her seminal work, Dr. Deva Pager, who was a Peter and Isabel Malkin professor of public policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and professor of sociology at the university before her recent untimely death, documented what she called the powerful effects of race on hiring decisions. Employers, she found, were more likely to hire a white man, even if he had a felony conviction, than a black man with no criminal record. Blacks who said they had a criminal record had a callback rate of 5%, and blacks who said they did not had a rate of 14%. For whites, the rates were 17% for those who said they had a criminal record and 34% for those who said they did not. A new paper from three respected economists with over 400,000 data points over 50 metro areas shows that African Americans pay more for identical housing in identical neighborhoods than their white counterparts, and that this rent gap increases with the fraction of the neighborhood and its racial percentages. So the more white it gets, the higher the premium goes for blacks entering that neighborhood. Similar studies have been done on residential steering practices in the real estate industry and the differential costs of insurance, mortgage rates, and so on paid by economically similar black and non-black applicants. Now, a potential limitation of any racial disparity comparisons is that they are sometimes not apples to apples. For example, we know that not having a high school degree is actually the greatest predictor of whether one ends up involved in the criminal justice system. Nevertheless, even among high school dropouts, 4 out of 10 African-American males end up in prison compared to 1 in 10 of their white counterparts. The ACLU found that African Americans are 4 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than whites, even though their rate of marijuana usage was comparable. In New York City alone, there were over 5 million stops and frisks between 2002 and 2012. 85% of those stopped were black and Latino, leading to the legal challenge that found the practice racially discriminatory and unconstitutional. So let me stop here. I may not have convinced you that we continue to live in a society in which racial discrimination leading to unequal life chances is a problem, though I hope I have at least dented the automatic presumption that some may have that this is not true. I want to turn to a second area in which I think we can see how racism, both as a message and a practice, remains harmful with respect to our political life and the health of our democracy. Let's call this the contemporary force of political racism. Once again, we are all likely familiar with the fact that political racism has been a part of U.S. history from its inception, including the defense of slavery, overseas expansion, Jim Crow segregation, and now white nationalism. Political racism has been a tool to divide the electorate and to suppress participation in democratic politics. We can locate its real origins in the aftermath of the Civil War and Reconstruction and the organized and systematic effort to suppress black men's ability to exercise the franchise through a variety of legal and extra-legal means, including literacy tests, poll taxes, police intimidation, and vigilante violence, up to and including lynching. Like the question of racial disparity, you might say, even if we accept the full scope of this kind of racism, it was in the past. It is no longer characteristic of our political present. In 1965, the United States finally fulfilled its promise by becoming a liberal democracy for the first time in its history with the passage of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts. We've been a liberal democracy for a short 50 years then, and notwithstanding the fact that we were a racial democracy and a racist democracy for almost 2 centuries prior, we can rest assured that the racist past is behind us. At least this was the view of the U.S. Supreme Court, which in 2013, in Shelby versus Holder, lifted the provisions of the Voting Rights Act that had required states with long histories of suppressing black voting rights to get federal approval to change any voting laws. Lo and behold, after Shelby, 24 states implemented new restrictions on voting. Texas, Alabama now require photo IDs to cast a ballot. Other states, such as Ohio and Georgia, have enacted use-it or lose-it laws, which strike voters from the registration rolls if they have not participated in an election within a prescribed period of time. Let's just look at one state where this dynamic has unfolded, the still-contested race for governor in the state of Georgia, an election characterized by red-baiting and race-baiting of the black candidate Stacey Abrams, who President Trump described as unqualified for office, even though she graduated from the same law school as Brett Kavanaugh. Setting Trump's words aside, the election process has been overseen by Abrams' opponent, Brian Kemp, who has been the Secretary of State of the state of Georgia for the past 8 years and refused to recuse himself, even though he was a party to the election that he was overseeing. During his time as Secretary of State, Kemp aggressively purged 1.5 million people, almost 10% of all people on the voting rolls. He closed more than 214 polling places. He criminally prosecuted people on trumped-up charges of voter fraud. In the run-up to the election, he blocked 53,000 voter registrations in the state, 70% from African Americans, 80% from people of color, which is close to the margin of his current lead. And he oversaw the delivery of voting machines without power cords to 3 predominantly African American counties. U.S. federal court ruled yesterday that Gwinnett County's mass rejection of absentee ballots based on an omitted or incorrect birth year violates the Civil Rights Act. The county is more than 50% African American and Latino. More damning, almost all of Kemp's maneuvers, striking people from the rolls for not having an exact match, that is where the name on the voter rolls is identical to the name in the state system, was actually disallowed under the Voting Rights Act as discriminatory against minority voters when Georgia tried to implement it in 2009. Georgia, of course, is not alone in these high-tech Jim Crow shenanigans, and we can discuss other examples later. I wager that it is difficult to find a similar analog, such as anti-racist voter suppression. Most anti-racists I know are struggling to increase Democratic participation and widen the use of the franchise where they are trying to contest elections. But I realize that this issue is now infused with partisanship. You hear it in my voice. And my account might not yet have convinced you that racism remains harmful in ways that dwarfs any concern we might have about anti-racist excesses. So let me turn to my third and final set of examples, the harmfulness of racially motivated and racist violence in the current moment. On June 17, 2015, just a few months before the election of Donald Trump as U.S. president, Dylann Roof entered the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church and killed 9 people, all African Americans, including senior pastor and state senator Clementa Pinckney. On social media, Roof posed with symbols of white supremacy and neo-Nazism, along with a manifesto in which he outlined derogatory views towards blacks, among other people. Just 2 weeks ago, another white man tried to enter the First Baptist Church in Jeffersontown, Kentucky. Finding the door locked, he entered Kroger's grocery store and murdered 2 black women. Coming upon a white patron, he demurred, uttering the sentence, "White doesn't kill white." Just over a week later, another white man shouting anti-Semitic slurs entered a synagogue in Pittsburgh and massacred 12 congregants. For months prior, he had spewed hate memes on right-wing social media that Jews were the enemy of white people. The synagogue shooter was apparently particularly incensed by the immigrant and refugee support work done by the Tree of Life congregation. And of course, the most recent actions occurred against a backdrop of an election that Trump consistently depicted as a brown invasion at the southern border, and that his Vice President Pence added was likely infiltrated by Islamic militants. Just this past Monday, an attorney representing Patrick Stein, one of 3 men convicted of plotting to bomb Somali refugees, filed memo in U.S. District Court in Kansas. Stein, his lawyer argued, should receive a more lenient sentence because he was inspired by then-candidate Donald Trump. Are these, then, just outliers? The Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism has reported that 71% of extremist-related fatalities in the United States between 2008 and 2017 were committed by members of the far-right or white supremacist movements. Reported hate crimes in America rose 17% last year, the 3rd consecutive year that such crimes increased, according to newly released FBI data that showed an even larger increase in anti-Semitic attacks. In conclusion, let me make a couple of points. Both sides do it is often the refrain, and both sidesism is unfortunately built into the structure of what is in question here. Anti-racism and racism are equally harmful. And let us not forget, after Charlottesville, as funny as our opening act was, when white supremacists chanted, "Jews will not replace us," and murdered a counter-protester, this was Trump's argument when he insisted that there are good and bad people on both sides. But I see little to no real evidence that anti-racism or anti-racists have as yet participated in anything on the order of the kinds of democratic voter suppression or racially motivated violence that we are seeing in the current moment. The last thing I want to say, not only is racism harmful, it makes us stupid. Even before Trump took office, his presidential transition team began drawing up plans to redirect national security resources away from white supremacists to focus solely on Islamic terrorism, which has been 3 times less significant in terms of the fatalities it has produced in this period than white supremacist or right-wing terror. The main target of this effort was countering violent extremism, an interagency task force created by Barack Obama in the wake of the Charleston church shooting to help prevent acts of violence before they happen. Perhaps the worst that can be said about anti-racism is that it is ineffective, based mostly on shaming racists. In the face of structural, political, and overt, in face of structural racism, political racism, and overt racist violence, empty moralism will not do. Not only do we need to do more as a society to overcome historic racist inequalities, or racism's historic inequalities, but we need to stop rewarding or whitewashing political racism, and we need to prevent, prosecute, and punish racist violence. None of this suggests that anti-racism is really the problem. If anything is true, we need a more capacious and inclusive and effective anti-racism that draws upon the legacies of our better history. Thank you.
Rebuttal from John McWhorter.
Thank you, Nikhil. You're quite right that racism exists and it's a problem, and these violent events are absolutely important attestation of it. But I'm not sure that I agree that anti-racism is just a kind of fashion statement nipping at heels. I may not have made myself clear. Here's another example. So, poverty makes boys in particular more likely to act up. That's a fact. That's been shown in countless studies. Now, often in especially public schools across the country, black boys are disciplined more than white boys. Now, one reason that the black boys might be acting up more is because of the effects of poverty, and that is something that needs to be addressed by concrete action rather than people putting their hand in the air and saying that they attest to their white privilege. But instead, what we often see is claims, especially from certain academic departments, that the only reason that black boys could be censured or suspended more would be racist bias. And if you look at all the studies on this, they basically just come down to a draw. In this city, starting in 2015, Mayor de Blasio spearheaded an effort to have black boys disciplined less in our hardest inner city schools with the highest proportions of black kids. That's good anti-racism. But the problem is that over the past 3 years, in all of those schools where people have so many problems already, this is right here in this city, and it's not only here, a similar story is in Philadelphia, you have more alcohol use, more drug use, more violence, and more gang activity, keeping these poor kids who are, you know, often black, all of them, from getting a good education, all out of a sense that it's racist to discipline black boys who are keeping the vast majority of students in the school from learning. That's not a fashion statement nipping at the heels. That's a real problem. Violence is a horrible thing when somebody like Dylann Roof pulls what he did. Charlottesville was not a joke. Those things are definitely happening. But there are two things going on here. There are those isolated events where grievous things happen to perfectly innocent people. Then there's an issue of lifting the black race up in general and solving general disparities. And we often tend to think that that's practically impossible, when really a lot of the problem is the things that we're encouraged to focus on are based much more on the idea that our main focus is supposed to be making sure that we're not discriminating against black people rather than actually helping black people. And something else. A little example of that. Voting. What the Republicans are doing in terms of trying to suppress the black vote is obvious, and it's one of the most revolting things I have ever seen. It's a horrible effort. However, there's something that you're not supposed to say, and I'm going to say it. There is a difference between the motivation for that now and the motivation for what was going on during Jim Crow and before, and we all know it. What the Republicans are doing is disgusting, and it's racist in terms of the definition that we use today. It hurts black people, and it devalues black people, certainly. But having just come from making my way through that new Frederick Douglass biography that we're reading about and hoping we might get through, you could hurt your foot if you dropped it on you. But I actually read it all the way through. The reason that they didn't want black people to vote then was because they thought black people were animals. My grandparents had trouble voting in cities like Atlanta, not because Republicans didn't want to have Democrats have too many votes, and they thought that it would be a canny thing to go for the group that votes for Democrats so consistently. That's cynical and disgusting in itself. But the reason was because they thought that people of my grandparents' generation were animals. So there's kind of a difference. Yes, what's going on with voting is a serious problem, but if we're talking about what racism is, frankly, the way I feel is that Americans tend to treat black America, and to convince black America that this is true, that we are the weakest, most feckless hothouse flowers in the 300,000-year history of the human species, and that that is how we should have policy approached. I just don't believe it, and I think that it is a serious problem. We could be doing better on civil rights now than we are.
Okay, I want to say a couple things. I mean, first of all, I couldn't agree more with the last statement that we could be doing better on civil rights than we are. I also think I made the case, and probably could make it if I had more time in more detail, that when we look at the upsurge of white supremacist violence in the United States, we are not actually talking about a few isolated incidents. We're actually talking about the movement of something that may once have been fringe, or maybe once was forbidden and then became fringe, into quite mainstream political discourse. And when you see the president retweeting white supremacists, or when you see him echoing arguments that were made by white supremacists, then you have to ask the question about what kind of shifts in our political culture are underway. I think that they're extremely concerning. I think they should be concerning to all of us. I imagine they are concerning to all of you. I think they're concerning to John, as he acknowledged. So I don't think we're talking about something that is isolated. I think we're talking about something that is reanimated. And I do agree also with John that I don't think most Americans are walking around with deep-seated racial animus that is kind of enlivening them all the time. But I do think a substantial number are. And I strongly disagree with the idea that that animus has somehow fundamentally changed. I mean, it's interesting in the rebuttal to me that John kind of wants to have it both ways. He wants to say that anti-racists are so obsessed with motivation and inner psychology that they're not seeing what's actually being done to people. But then he turns around and says voter suppression in Georgia is not really motivated by the same thing. It's actually sort of, you know, coming from some different place. They just want to get the votes. Well, why do they want to get the votes? They want to get the votes because they want to continue to create certain kinds of conditions which produce and rely on both racial and economic inequality. And I strongly agree with John that we cannot be separating, if this is what I understand him to be saying, issues of racial and economic inequality. We have to be talking about them together. I'm not that interested in converting people from their inner-held racist thoughts. I'm interested in them stopping acting in racist ways. And the burden of my remarks today was to suggest that we live in a society where more and more people are being emboldened to act in racist ways in our political process, in the streets, and that both of those things connect to and build upon the fact that we continue to have a society that is divided and unequal in racial terms. And those inherited racial inequalities do come from a deep past that we have never properly reckoned with in public policy or in our public history. Okay? So if that's what I mean by anti-racism, and I am an anti-racist, and I probably would in our conversation agree with certain aspects of what John is saying. I don't actually think that a lot of things that he's saying are things that I would strongly take issue with necessarily. I don't necessarily want us to trivialize the kind of struggles and conflicts and divisions that we have in our society right now. And I certainly don't want to imagine, and I never have in my work imagined, that African Americans in particular are some sort of benighted
kind of failed people that can't manage for themselves. I've always taken heart from the great phrase from Malcolm X, which the problem with a segregated school is not that black people are in one and white people are in another, but that nobody cares about the black school. Nobody's investing in it. Nobody's putting resources into it. That's where we need to look to understand where the rubber meets the road on racism today. So I'm all for that. But to me, that just goes back to my last point in my opening remarks. We need a more effective anti-racism in this society. We need to actually redress the histories of racial inequality that we're still saddled with. Then maybe we'll stop having this conversation in the same way. I'm not sure we'll get to the promised land because I don't actually see politics in those terms. So in that sense, I think John's arguing not necessarily with me, but with a kind of phantom of his own imagination. And I'm not saying it's completely outside the bounds of what I hear in universities and from students, but I don't actually take that to be reflective of what is actually going on in the world that we live in right now.
Thank you both. We're going to be opening up to questions shortly, but I want to line up. And first, as you both know, you have the option of asking the other a question at any time. Do either of you want to pose a question to the other at this point? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Nikhil, what does it mean to redress the disparities of the past? How would we do that? Because when I say that there are things that we utter that seem, and I'm not accusing you of being some sort of fantasist, but when I say that we can slip into the incantational, mm-hmm. What's the redressing? What would we do that we haven't done already? And I understand that there needs to be activism on behalf of disenfranchised black people. But redressing the past, what do you mean?
Well, this is obviously a huge conversation to open up, so I'll try to give a brief and directed answer. In your remarks, you talked in the beginning about the way in which we see criminal justice involvement as if it's somehow an exclusively black issue, specifically black men being killed by the police. And I think that everything that you said in those opening remarks, I could not agree with you more. And I do a lot of work with people in prison. So we get a distorted view of the world, in part, when we look at it through an exclusively racial prism. Okay, we don't see the scope, again, of how issues of race connect to socioeconomic issues, to issues of poverty, to issues of spatial isolation, to a whole range of issues. So I'm all on board with that kind of argument. But I would say that if you look at the history of the punitive turn in carceral policy in the United States, that it was sold politically to publics through what I'm calling political racism. In other words, it was the figure of, you know, to go back to any number of figures, the Central Park Five, which Donald Trump raised as these wild boys that should be executed, and even though they were later proved to be innocent, he still didn't acknowledge that. It goes back to the Willie Horton ad that George H.W. Bush used to defeat Michael Dukakis. It goes back to Hillary Clinton's language of super predators and Ronald Reagan's language of gangbangers and so forth in the drug war. Right? So we have a long history of politicians using a racialized discourse to sell us on punitive policies that have harmed black communities and harmed poor whites. Perhaps we could argue about the proportionality there, but that have been devastating for our society. Right? So to me, that is an example of how political racism works, how it's been harmful, how it remains harmful. So a part of redressing that would be figuring out how we start to undo that, not act that way, oppose that, and change the dynamic of how we do our politics.
You have identified where we differ. Now, okay. What you're saying is true, and it might surprise you to hear that, yes, the war on drugs, and it's actually been made clearer, especially over the past 2 or 3 years, had a racial component. That was an anti-black policy. It was also something that happened when I was one. Now, I'm not saying that the past is just the past. What you just said is true. But this is 2018, and what I mean by it's 2018 is I have cousins in jail. I know the sorts of things that they did,
And I know that in most cases, they really shouldn't be in jail. What do we do about it now? And I want to put this carefully, but talking about the Willie Horton ad isn't going to get cousin XXX out of jail. I think we need to talk about, for example, ending the war on drugs and not just a little stuff with weed. Very important. That should be absolutely crucial to talking about what goes on with both white and black poor people, especially men. Because what we're talking about is something that eternally tempts underserved men into a black market and into not getting their diploma and winding up the kind of statistics that we're talking about. To me, that should be the main thing we focus on instead of, and with all due respect, instead of the, there's only one word, the recitation that you just did, a very important and disgusting history. That happened. I don't think we can reverse talking about that and the fact that it was done by people who were really shitty. We can't fix them. Most of them are dead. So what do we do now?
Actually, one of them's president.
Granted. But what do we do now? That's my question.
Well, you know, I 100% agree with you. And the war on drugs. I mean, we could have a policy discussion of what needs to be done. And I would say, and the war on drugs would be at the forefront. I think what happened in Florida with the ending of felon disfranchisement, Amendment 4 was a magnificent thing, you know, and that was won by voting rights activists working for years in that state. I think that's the kind of thing that we have to pursue across the board. I started a prison education program at NYU where we go back into prisons and jails with other colleges have done and try to provide education for people in prison so that when they come out of prison, they have opportunities. All the prison education programs got wiped out in the 1990s with the crime bill, which is not that long ago. The problem is, when I rehearse the litany, it's not because it's a catechism to me, it's because it's a cumulative history that repeats itself, that gets reinstantiated, that gets reconstituted by new policymakers and ambitious and unscrupulous politicians who want to manipulate us in these kinds of ways. And we now have one of them in the White House that's using a different set of racial codes and racial fears to make us think that, like, our major problem is immigrants coming across the border. Now, you know, that's why I would talk in those terms, but I'm certainly not averse to having the kind of policy discussion about what needs to be done. And I think my own view and my own practice is to think very much in those terms. So
here, one more thing.
And then I have one for you.
Okay. How far do you think we can get in teaching people not to be racist? Because my personal feeling, especially after 2016, is that we've hit a wall there. And that in terms of making life better for people left behind who can't help themselves, telling the Americans who are left who are racist, and it's not just a few, telling them, stop that. It's not going to work. It was one thing to say in the 50s and 60s, give black people the right to vote, to work as a lawyer, to eat where you eat. It was one thing to say in 1968, Fair Housing Act, black people can live where you live. And then it was another thing to say through Norman Lear sitcoms and general shaming, don't be a bigot. I'm not sure that we can come any further. And it seems to me that if we're talking about people carrying torches in Charlottesville, they're beyond reason. And so whatever we're going to do, I'm inclined to do it without, I'm sure you'll understand that it is a kind of preaching. That kind of preaching, simply because I don't see how it works anymore. You may know something I don't about the efficacy of it.
I don't disagree with you. I don't think shame works. I think we're in a political culture that thrives on shaming, that thrives on the kind of frisson of shame. I think, as I said before, part of the right-wing strategy right now to kind of move the Overton window is to take things that were forbidden, to make them fringe, and then make them mainstream. The fact that I think we even start to frame debates in the ways that we're framing them tonight seems to me to be slightly part of that. I mean, I wish anti-racism were a civil religion in the United States, as you suggested. I think it was in some ways. I don't think it is actually quite so right now. But no, I don't believe that we can necessarily convince racists through reason or through shame. I think we have to crush them politically. And I think that that's going to come through organization. It's going to come through education. It's going to come through people understanding the kind of like high-tech Jim Crow maneuvers that are going on in Georgia, which I don't think are available or well understood by most people. I think it's going to come by in certain moments through presenting a very strong principled stand where we don't allow ourselves to be cowed in certain ways. There are lots of methods, I think, for approaching the problem. But I do agree with you. I don't think yelling and shouting at people and calling them racist is going to work. And then the last thing I would say is that, as I said in my remarks, I don't ultimately care 100% if someone is racist. I mean, we have a big conversation about the white working class right now and whether people have racist attitudes. There are people who have racist attitudes who are led in various ways to vote against what may be their economic interests. And I believe that we have to convince people to vote for their interests and vote in the right ways. And that might mean that they then enter into a coalition with people that they have racist attitudes towards. And when they enter into that coalition with people with racist attitudes, and we see this through the history of the labor movement, sometimes those racist attitudes start to change. The only way they really start to change is if people actually are working together towards concrete ends. They don't start to change by people hectoring each other and calling each other names. So I'm on board with that.
And the concrete ends, I think, would be more important than how the Archie Bunker feels, ultimately.
I agree.
Right?
I agree. So, John, let me ask you. I read your article, you know, about anti-racism as a civil religion, and you know, I thought it was measured and I thought it was smart, and you know, but I wonder, you know, you wrote that and published it in 2015, so we're here in 2017. 2018. Sorry, that shows where my mind is. I have small children. That's my excuse.
I know how that is.
Time stands still. So what would you change? Has any of your own thinking changed since you wrote that article in 2015?
No, not a word. No, I wrote that article knowing full well that there are a lot of racist people in this country. I was not as completely surprised by the election of Donald Trump as many people were. I think that most of the people who voted for him are not what I would call a racist. They just don't consider racism a priority, and many people would consider it the same thing. No, life sucks. That didn't surprise me. Now, that article actually is one of the few that I actually sometimes reread, and I think, wow, that nothing has changed. I believe that Black America would benefit from a roughly 4 or 5 plank platform that could happen and in which Black people could thrive, regardless of how Donald Trump or anybody who voted for him felt. And I think, frankly, most Black people of all stations in life don't care that much how white people feel. But I think an awful lot can happen, and we start losing imagination. I'm hearing it from you when you're talking about these coalitions within which racism might exist, but that's not something that we usually talk about. There's this sense that the main meal must be combating the feelings that people have out of a certain one idea that once those feelings go away, that life will then be able to get better for a Black person in a housing project. I don't think that Bayard Rustin and Roger Wilkins and Martin Luther King or even Malcolm X thought that way. I think that it's something that's settled in for us moderns. And I'd like to get away from it because I think that great things, really good things, can happen for the Black community, despite the fact that we will live in an imperfect nation, which will always be riven by racism. I think I said that at the end of the article that you're talking about, that there can be a platform, or maybe it was the article I wrote after that. I don't think, now, violence is a hideous thing. I'm not minimizing that. But I don't think racist attitudes are as important as we're often told, mainly because I don't think we can do anything about them.
You want to make a comment? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'll have one last sort of crack at this. So, you know, one of the things that kind of disturbed me a little bit about your piece in 2015 was the sort of the resonances it has, and I don't think any of this is intentional on your part, and I'm not accusing you of anything. I want to just be clear about that. I even hesitated to bring this up. But in the European far right now, you see this argument from people like Guillaume Fay and Daniel Freeberg, that anti-racism is a totalitarian religious ideology. Okay, that's the framing they use. Fay writes, the touchstone of the self-righteous anti-racism is the most advanced expression of postmodern totalitarian ideology. So this is a kind of a far-right meme, kind of like cultural Marxism these days. And there's one line in your essay that troubled me, where you say, anti-racism is a flawed religion that, quote, pollutes our racial dialogue. And that word pollution bothered me. And I know you're a linguist, and I know you're linguistically sensitive, and I even hesitate to argue with you on this terrain, knowing how clever you are. But the language of pollution, I think, to my way of thinking, you know, and the way it's connected to an idea of anti-racism is some kind of, as I've said, a kind of phantom that sweeps over this conversation. We moderns have this kind of psychologistic sort of obsession with race or something. It strikes me a little bit like it's kind of something made up. You know, I see elements of it sometimes in my students, but I see it as a sign of their youth, their desire for purity, politics, and so forth. And it's not confined to race. It runs the gamut of other things. As far as psychologism goes, it's rife throughout American society, right? We're always talking about self-help and betterment and being better people, and we're preoccupied with sin and guilt and all this kind of stuff. But to sort of focus on anti-racism as something that is polluting our dialogue at this moment seems to me to be a kind of a dangerous way of going about talking about this issue, which is one of the reasons why I really pulled back to kind of say, what is racism today? We have structural racism, we have political racism, and we have racist violence. That's what racism is. That's what we need to oppose. To me, anti-racism is opposition to racism. So I haven't accepted your terms for this argument in a sense, right? But I actually think there are lines of agreement. I know we're supposed to fight and we're supposed to try to win, you know, one side or the other. But I actually think that I don't accept the framing that you've given to this, you know, and I've sort of offered a different framing. Is there anything in my framing, and this is why I asked you the question, if your thinking has changed at all in the last 2 years? Mm-hmm. That might make you want to reconsider at all the kind of way in which certain arguments are now deployed in the right wing sort of Ethernet, whatever it is, and the way they're circulating.
There's always a danger of that kind of misinterpretation when you write something and you're trying to make a strong argument. And there's a certain point at which I don't mean to sound flippant, but I can't be concerned with how an Austrian politician might interpret something that I write in the Daily Beast. But I think, frankly, that you and I have a very different sense of the prevalence of this religion. I very much think that it is the civil religion of, let me clarify, not America in general. I mean blue America. I mean educated America. And educated America has a certain influence. Now, step beyond that, certainly this kind of anti-racism starts tottering severely. We've seen that in who has become president. But in terms of we of the chattering classes who have an awful lot of the power, I think that it is much more than the occasional hot-headed undergraduate. It starts there, but it's also true in terms of faculty and hirings and the way graduate students are treated. I think with this audience, I don't even need to recount. Basically, all you have to do is open up Quillette and you will see all of these things described. These are real things. It has affected my own academic career. And remember, I'm not a social scientist. I just play one on TV. I'm a linguist. And these sorts of things have been real for a while and have really crested since 2013. And I find that they really do. Here's a quick example. Suppose there's a book by a leading black thinker that basically expresses an extremely anti-white viewpoint, right down to saying that this person has children, he sees them playing here in New York with white kids at his elementary school, and is afraid because he's afraid that his child doesn't understand what white people are capable of. And let's say the book is full of things like that. And it's clear that this person really doesn't like white people very much. And this person's book is assigned for white people of our world to read all over the country. And let's say that someone like me has white friends who, for example, come to his house from a reading group where everybody had to read that book, which basically says that it's okay to be a very brilliant black person and to exhibit a spontaneous, hostile, anti-white animus and elevate it as serious thought. And you can see in that white person's eyes that she understands that what that book said is not something that she fully agrees with. She doesn't think that her children are worth being thought of that way, that she's worth being thought of in the ways that this book portrays her. But her answer is, I'm not supposed to judge. How do I know how he feels? And so I thought it was wonderful. Well, for one thing, that's a polluted dialogue because, one, it's incoherent. It doesn't really make sense. And two, that person, who is one of the nicest people in the world, is unintentionally being condescending. She's not requiring of that author the rigor that she would require of, frankly, a white author, of a Jonathan Franzen, of a Steve Pinker. And therefore, by extension, it's condescending to me. Yes, it's partly about me. That's the sort of thing that we're seeing. It's not just the occasional undergraduate who breaks something in the cafeteria and complains about Vietnamese food that isn't authentic. This is big. And you and I live in the same world, and I think it's interesting that we perceive this differently. But I want to make it clear that I do think that in our world, it is a dominant religion. And part of the way we know it is that just like medievals, we don't know it's a religion. We don't think about it. The medievals didn't say they were religious. It was just the way the world was thought to be. That's where we are now.
Okay. I want to take moderator's prerogative to ask two questions of you, and then with the audience. Question for John McWhorter. Nikhil was at first reviewing what I think he called structural racism. He went over a series of statements about how more difficult to get a job if you're black, difficult to get decent housing, basically portrayed a situation in which there is a pattern of racism against blacks with respect to housing, jobs, and so on. Do you accept his characterization, or do you challenge it in any important way?
Oh, I don't want to overtalk because I just did. But no, I don't challenge those things. Everything that I'm saying is said within a context of knowing that there are those disparities. Some of them are more complicated than we're often told, but not enough to matter.
The disparities, yes. Disparities due to racism, you think?
Yeah, okay. One can say that.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. Question for Nikhil. John mentioned two or three very specific, four or five actually, specific examples of anti-racism that he felt are very harmful. The recent one he mentioned a couple of them, was, for example, that it's regarded as racist to discipline black kids in schools who create turmoil, and that holds everybody back. He mentioned that there's far less concern about the danger from black gangs toward black people, the much greater possibility, that chance of getting killed by another black person than by a white cop. Then the third thing he mentioned, for example, was that affirmative action makes it hard for black kids to function in schools where they're overqualified. Do you regard those three things, for example, as bad examples of anti-racism that should be stopped?
Well, I'm not going to speak to them all in turn. Let me just say that I can see how affirmative action can produce stereotype threat, what the psychologist Claude Steele has called stereotype threat. And I can see how it could work to produce a kind of stigma among the recipient. And that might not be a positive thing. But that's also because we have not actually understood necessarily how difficult it might be for somebody coming from a certain place to get to a certain place, right? So the problem of racism, from my standpoint, is actually in many ways encapsulated by the ways in which it's been characterized by this side of the debate, which is like, we all know that. Well, if we all knew that, if we all knew these things, if we all knew the depth of discrimination, of its persistence, then why have we not been able to produce the kind of public policy to address it? I don't think the reason for that is anti-racism, actually. I think the reason for that is that there hasn't been the public will and interest in addressing that, and that actually our public policies have been turned towards racist ends, and as in the carceral turn. And John, you know, points to the example of de Blasio in punishing black boys, and to me that's actually an outlier. I don't think that that's actually what happens in most parts of the country, in most schools, where African-American children are being disciplined and where we have something that we know quite well is a school-to-prison pipeline. There's tons of research on this. Many, many urban schools now have police in the schools where if there's an infraction, that people are actually immediately put into a situation of potential criminal punishment, particularly African-American children. Mm-hmm. So I think it's misleading, actually, that example. And then I guess the last thing I want to say, and it sort of comes back to the longer set of remarks that John was making, I can completely see how it would be a problem to feel condescended to. You know, and I can completely see how people not being truthful and not feeling like they can speak openly and actually debate things does, let's say, I wouldn't use the word pollute, distort, disturb, undermine our dialogue. But once again, I feel like you are actually talking about feelings. You're talking about your feelings. You're talking about the negative feelings that might produce in a kind of elite a space of the cocktail party or their dinner party or the academic department. You're actually not addressing what I think is a much more significant harm that is being done to people by the ways in which existing and ongoing racial disparities, racist demagoguery, and racializing public policy actually works in our society. So I would much rather us be talking about those things. I think if we were actually talking about those things, rather than just saying, oh, we all know that, you know, then we actually might have a different conversation. We might actually have a different kind of anti-racism.
Okay. You want to make a comment on that?
I do. Yeah. So let's try this. End the war on drugs. Make sure that all poor women have long-acting reproductive contraception available to them at no or little charge. Make sure that any child below a certain income level is taught to read via phonics rather than via the whole word method. I know that sounds wonky. That is huge. But because it's kind of undramatic and it doesn't have the air of anti-racism about it, nobody really wants to talk about it. Then cherish and support vocational training. Get rid of the idea that to be a human being you have to go to 4 years of school where you pretend to enjoy Shakespeare. Very important. I know so many young black men who are electricians or, you know, repairmen making more money than I made until rather late in my life. That should be taught now. That should be emphasized now. If you did just those four things, we would be in a new world. Instead, let's imagine that there's a very artfully written article about how we need to once again call for reparations, written as if reparations hadn't been discussed to death around the turn of the millennium and thought of by people from all sides of the political spectrum as an unfeasible idea, partly because you could say that there have already been reparations. But the idea is so incoherent.
John, the Ta-Nehisi Coates is not stopping your ideas from emerging. It's the GOP Congress. It's the Democratic Party.
I disagree.
It's the political system that we live in.
No.
That has the party duopoly and the ways in which it has worked to actually prevent public policies that would actually address systemic economic inequality in a serious way. It is a phantom that you're producing here.
No, it's not. Can you really tell me that there's any evidence that if the Democrats were in power, that the four things that I talked about, or even three, or even two, would actually be given serious consideration?
Absolutely.
And remember,
not.
It's not just me. I'm not making this up. These are things that I'm getting from people who know what they're talking about.
I 100% agree with you. If the Democrats were in power, those things won't happen, which is why we need to actually transform the Democratic Party. We need to make the Democratic Party a genuine social democratic party.
I would agree with
that. So, you know, when and if that happens, we may have the, I mean, I'll come back for the socialism debate next time. But, you know, if we have something like that happen, then we will have a different kind of political... I'm not pinning my hopes on the Democratic Party either. I just don't think that the problems that are sort of as they are identified by Quillette or as they are sort of pinned on some kind of narrow band of academic discussion are actually even touching most of what's happening on the ground, where people live, how people are suffering, how people are striving. And I'm 100% with you that we should be doing those things. But I don't think anti-racism is the thing that's causing the harm. I think the things that are causing the harm are many of the things that have long caused the harm, right? Which is a kind of variety, as I laid out, of racist and classist structures within our society that have produced disparity, that have produced premature death, that have produced over-incarceration, and that have produced the kind of civil conflict that we now experience.
So your claim is that the intelligentsia of our nation have no particular or interesting effect on what sorts of policies are talked about and eventually...
Oh, not at all. The economics profession has an enormous impact. I don't think the economics...
But apparently not high-profile magazines.
Oh, no. The economic profession in general I don't think gives a shit about reparations or Ta-Nehisi Coates. I think most of political science doesn't care a little bit about it, not one bit. I don't think you'd find it in the Wall Street Journal. I don't think you'd find it in Barron's. I don't think you'd find it in the Financial Times. I mean, you may have the odd review here or there, but that is not the discourse that is ruling the world. The discourse that's ruling the world is the discourse of money and finance austerity and the sort of limitations that are going to be placed on governmental intervention. Very little of it is actually addressing issues of race and racial disparity.
You guys have been great. There's been an extended debate between the two guys, which I think we've very much appreciated. I do want to make it open to audience questions. Somebody in the audience, I don't see the mic. Somebody at the mic want to ask the first question? Yeah, there you go. Oh, it's over there. My God. Okay. Please make it a question and not a statement. Go ahead.
Yes. Okay. Great discussion thus far, gentlemen. I know that.
That's a statement. Question.
I know Gene enjoys. Wait a minute. Gene enjoys brevity. I understand, but I'm standing in front of John McCorder, who I've loved your work for so long. Your conversations with Glenn Lowry are indispensable for anybody who cares about race.
Thank you very much.
Nikhil, I look forward to pouring into your work further. A question about the discussion about race in general. Obviously, in this room, it's of a very high level with you two gentlemen. My question is, the wider race discussion outside of this theater, outside of Soho Forum, has it hit a wall? Does it need to be redirected? Is it stuck? Because I find so much of it are not people who care about actual policy prescriptions, but people who are performative, who are arguing things on a surface level. We've mentioned the drug war here. Drug war is important. I don't know why people aren't yelling about it every day. Instead, we're talking about how Trump talks to reporters. It lacks substance. So I'm just wondering, you know, how do we get out of where we're at now to a wider, more substantive discussion? And I know that that's a tall order, but if anybody can do it, you know, you guys can.
Well, I think that one way that we could make it more substantive, because I don't think that it is, I mean, apparently the intelligentsia doesn't matter, but as somebody who tries to pretend to be part of it, I think that this America should become more aware that there is a difference between having a religion and being interested in political activism, such that it becomes less important what's the latest racist thing that Donald Trump said. You know, it's hard being a writer in these times, because my general thought is, yes, I've known he was a racist since before he was president. He's going to keep saying those things because he's mentally 10, and that's what he does. And so there's nothing interesting about it. Yes, we should be talking about the war on drugs. I think that, with all due respect to Nikhil's view, I think a lot of the reasons that we talk more about what Trump says about Omarosa, although there's also a sexist issue there too, rather than what would help somebody like someone's cousin who is unjustly in prison, is because we're dealing with, I hate using this very punitive word, but virtue signaling now stands in for being politically concerned. A person who
in 1965 would have said, what can I do to help, is now asking, how can I show that I'm a moral person? But that's more Martin Luther than Martin Luther King. I just made that up just now. There.
Again, as I knew, I was facing a very clever opponent. And let me just say...
That was really spontaneous.
Let me just say that if I have virtue signaled once tonight, I will do a mea culpa. That is not my purpose. I am a full believer in practical political activity. That is what we need to be doing. So I agree with John in many respects on this question. But when we talk about Trump's words and Trump's actions, we're not talking about Omarosa. This is just another example of a kind of trivialization. Trump, right during the election, talked about issuing an executive order to end birthright citizenship. Now, none of us necessarily think he can do that legally, but there are actually constitutional scholars who disagree on the question of whether birthright citizenship is mandated under the 14th Amendment. It's a serious, serious debate, and it's going to hinge on the juridical parsing of four words, right, under the jurisdiction of, you know, which are meant to apply to people who are born here. If you're born under the jurisdiction of, you're a birthright citizen. But are people who come here illegally or without papers in an unauthorized way, are they under the jurisdiction of the United States? This is going to be potentially a subject to debate. It's going to be a subject that is going to open up potential possibility of stripping citizenship from hundreds of thousands of people. Now, am I just being alarmist? Have you seen? Okay, perhaps. You think so? You think I'm being alarmist? That's good. I'm glad to have that out on the table because I personally don't think it's alarmist. I don't think it's an alarmist in a country that has engaged in family separation at the border, in a country that has engaged in torture during the Iraq War, in a country that has launched wars in the Middle East under false pretenses that have killed hundreds of thousands of people. You're not really supposed to heckle in this environment, but the fact that you are is indicative to me that you actually are not willing to have a reasoned debate about this. Right? So the point is that we have a situation where we are dealing with someone who is actually engaging in attacks that are racially inflected and framed that involve parts of the population and making them extremely vulnerable. So the idea that you want to trivialize it and make it something that we should just kind of ignore or laugh off or say, oh, let's just Donald Trump being Donald Trump, to me is sort of just kind of proving my point.
Next question.
Hi there. My worry is about blowback. Given that white America is still the majority of the U.S. population and that runs the gamut economically, what does that mean for the current state of anti-racism of white guilt and white privilege where you have people who are neither, who definitely aren't privileged? Are you laying a fertile ground for new racism to come in the future?
Am I laying the fertile ground?
Is the current situation of the religious situation of anti-racism laying a fertile ground for the next generation of racists?
So should I take that first?
Well, I
thought he was talking to you, but I should say...
Why don't you take the question, John? Take the question.
I just talked for a long time.
Just for the alternation.
Oh, okay. The truth is that if that kind of reasoning, that kind of anti-racist reasoning is aired and aimed, and a lot of it does involve abusing and making fun of and being condescending towards a certain kind of person who's viewed as and often is less enlightened, then it certainly is not a recipe for polity, and I don't see why it would not stir up a degree of racism. Now, once again, for me, and it's not that I'm trivializing it, Nikhil, and I don't think it's funny, but I think to an extent that kind of racism is always going to be there. And so, for example, now this is where I think just people will differ. Trump is definitely creating an environment where people are being more open about feelings that probably 10 years ago they would keep more to themselves. He's basically winking and saying that there are things that are okay, including violence, which is particularly frightening. But just in general, he is creating this idea that it's okay to be Archie Bunker.
My feeling really is that I would rather have it out in the open than have the people keeping it quiet and being polite and mumbling when my back is turned. I'd rather know what they're saying. I can see how maybe you might feel that progress would be if they, maybe we know that they're not gonna, we can't make them not have the feeling, but at least they won't say it, that it would be better if there was a kind of a politeness. I kind of want them to say it so I know who to avoid, and just because I feel like I'm living in, there's kind of a blue pill, red pill aspect to it for me. I want to know what world I'm actually living in. So things will differ. I don't know if we're talking about a racist onslaught, however. I don't think that anti-racism is dangerous in that it's going to create Charlottesville. Trump is more responsible for things like that.
May I just jump in a second and ask for clarification about the role of the intelligentsia? Would you agree, Nikhil, that Ta-Nehisi Coates writes bestsellers, MacArthur genius, a lot of writers spawned by him, influences the media? Would you agree that they play a role in influencing voter attitudes, and that voter attitudes then play a role at when they vote, and also influence politicians, so that it's not just, you know, the moneyed classes, that the intelligentsia clearly is an important force in the sense that I described? Would you agree with that?
Yes,
okay.
I would, of course.
All right. Well, okay, if that's the case, then would you agree then that Ta-Nehisi Coates, if he's saying what's really on the agenda is reparations, what's really on the agenda is understanding, as Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote, I had no sympathy for the white firefighters who died in the World Trade Center because they're white. That's what he wrote in his best-selling book. Would you agree that that's poisonous and that's out there? Would you think that's an influence?
I'm not going to comment on Ta-Nehisi's writings one way or another.
Well, he's a best-selling author. He's the intelligentsia.
Do I agree with I'll say this. Do I agree with everything in Ta-Nehisi Coates'
writings? His influence.
Yeah. I think his influence is he has an influence. Okay. But I would say does he have the outsized significance that some would attribute to him? I think he's become a magnet for all kinds of criticisms that really his work doesn't really bear up to. He's not a serious and deep historian. You know, he's somebody who has done, he writes beautifully, he writes well, he writes polemically and cleverly, and he's been influential. But I don't think his influential is actually shaping the public debate to the extent to which it may be being sort of assumed here. Okay. So that would be my response to that.
Final question for the audience.
Well, I suppose I have a single question that I'll split between the two of you. I believe it was, to paraphrase Aristotle, virtue exists at a means between two vices, and any virtuous behavior can be taken to a realm of excess where it inevitably becomes a vice. For Mr. McWhorter, where specifically do you see the vices in the current movement of anti-racism? And for Mr. Singh, like, what would you need to see for you to view of the current circumstance as what would you need to see for you to view the motion of this debate as a credible assertion? Forgive me.
Okay.
The vice of the modern civic religion, which is anti-racism, is that it's inwardly focused. It is an understandable but dangerous search for moral absolution based on what begins as a concern for people who need help, but it ends up being something that's self-centered. It's about the self. It has a manifestation with black people as well, where there is a sense that we can consider our roles to be to show white America that racism exists. And I think that there's a tendency, I think most of us are familiar with this to an extent. There's a certain attraction in painting yourself as someone who is a survivor of daily onslaughts of racism. If you're seeking for a sense of self-definition, if you're seeking for a sense of self-validation, and all of us as human beings do, if you're a black American in the United States since about 1970, one way that you can find that is to think of yourself as somebody who is a survivor of this onslaught. And so you end up being a kind of deacon within this religion. There's a whole different issue of what role black people have in it. And so that's a problem for the simple reason that when it's all about the self and all of this signaling, it ends up deflecting from
from concentrating the way people did 50 and 60 years ago on the ground policy. Being woke too often these days is just a matter of turning and doing high fives with people who think like you and not being concerned with doing the work and thinking about what really helps people. The overlap between that woke feeling and effective activism is only partial, and we're losing that. That's the vice for me.
I think John got a chance to do his summation. You had a tough question, Nikhil. The question was, what would have to be true for you to agree with John about the resolution? I think that was the question put to you. A tough question. Maybe you want to duck it. That would be okay.
What would have to be true for me to agree with John? I think I would have to think that John was really identifying something that was in the way of doing the concrete work that he says we need to do, but actually spends more time talking about the problems of anti-racism. So to me, if we were going to actually do the work, and I do spend a lot of time doing the work of trying to help people and do concrete social change work, where I don't think foregrounding anti-racist commitments is the important thing to do. I totally agree with that. But what I find puzzling in this kind of Quillette-like discourse, and I think John mentioned Quillette, is that there's a kind of desire to always find these moments where, you know, there's some egregious instance of political correctness that is preventing someone from like speaking what's really on their mind, some usually quite well-off and well-placed person from speaking what's on their mind, and that this is the thing that we should be worried about because this is the thing that's in the way of like making the world better, but I don't see any of these people actually doing any kind of serious concrete work. So it all to me seems a little bit like up here, and a lot of the kind of examples are counterfactuals, you know, what if this happened or what if that happened? Well, I've tried to talk about what is happening, and I've tried to identify it. And it's happening in Georgia right now. It's happening in the White House. It's happening in our policies. It's happening in churches and synagogues where people have been murdered. And, you know, this is the world we're in. And we can choose to kind of continue to spin out this kind of fake conversation, or we can deal with it.
I think I'm hearing summations from both sides. Unfortunately, we've gone over time way with the questions. You'll get a chance to, the guys are going to stick around over a glass of wine. They can talk to you about your questions. But you want to make.
Can I say one sentence?
Well, your summation starts.
I'm really going to be able to do one. Okay.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Well, I thought we were skipping that.
No, 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 we're not skipping. Oh, no, sorry. No, I was just jokingly saying you're doing the summations. Martin Luther King, you at least won the word game tonight and taken away with the summation.
You know what my summation here is? I've made my points. I do think that anti-racism is important. I do think that what the intelligentsia chooses as the terms of the discussion does have an effect on the progress of history and the progress of a people. That's the way history has always worked. That's certainly the way social history has worked in the United States, at least until about 5 minutes ago. I see no reason why it would change now. But I want to say one thing in response to Nikhil, what you said. These hypotheticals that you're mentioning, I understand that strategy of argumentation, but I think that from the beginning, my first statement, and with everything else I said, I have talked about concrete events. I have listed them. I have given names. I have given figures. I have talked about articles that describe things that are happening right here in the real America. I have most certainly not recited a bunch of hypotheticals. Thank you.
Well, this has been fun. So I'll just say what I've said, and I'll try to be as brief as John. So what John calls anti-racism and sees as a problem, in my way of thinking, is mostly a phantom. I deal with it. I deal with it in my classes. You know, I had a whole class last year where I read the N-word because Du Bois said it in a passage, and my students felt triggered by it. And they made me stop, and they said, you can't say that word. You know, you're not a black person. And I said, why would it matter if I was a black person and said that? And I had a conversation with them.
Now, do I want to go and say they're being triggered is just about them being self-obsessed, self-absorbed babies? No. Well, yeah, exactly. That's what you might say, because you might not actually be interested in having a constructive dialogue with them, but I'm their teacher, so I do have an interest in having a constructive dialogue with them. Now, I've suggested that persisting racial disparities in economic life and in our criminal justice system are underwritten by active and ongoing racial discrimination. I've suggested that there's been a resurgence of political racism and racially motivated voter suppression that now puts our democracy at risk. And last, I've suggested that the dangerous siren songs of race war and racist violence have moved from right-wing fringes of Stormfront and Gab and the Daily Caller to the Twitter deck of the US president. All of this should be cause for alarm. All of this suggests that racism is currently more harmful than anti-racism, and I'll be very curious to see how you all vote. Thank you.
Well, we're opening up the final vote, just want to take the opportunity to thank both sides for a very civil and very spirited exchange. Certainly, you both created an example for us all to discuss these issues of passion in a civil fashion, and to share your differences civilly and courteously with each other. So I commend you both on that, and thank you both for that. While you're considering the vote, I want to invite you all to come to our December 3rd debate. We're going to switch back to cash, to money. Harvard professor of economics Ken Rogoff, author of The Curse of Cash, will defend the resolution, governments of the advanced industrial economies should phase out the use of paper money in the form of large denomination notes and sharply restrict the use of cryptocurrencies. Arguing for the negative will be George Mason University Professor of Economics Lawrence White. On Monday, January 14th, we will have a debate that might interest our two debaters on the subject of housing. Richard Rothstein, Economic Policy Institute Research Associate, author of The Color of Law, will defend the resolution, since the federal government fostered housing segregation in the 20th century, the government should foster housing integration in the 21st. Taking the negative will be Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow Howard Hussock. On February 20th, John Allison, former CEO of the Cato Institute and former CEO of BB&T Bank, author of The Financial Crisis and the Free Market Cure, will defend a resolution about the causes of the financial crisis. How are we doing on the voting, Jane, at this point? Okay. Well, looks like we have the results. Recognize that how people vote initially has a lot to do with how they felt in the first place. Voting yes on the resolution. 41.5% initially voted yes, and that rose to 54.3%. And so the yes resolution picked up nearly 13 percentage points. That's what there is to beat. And the no's went from 15 to 29, 28 percentage points. And the disparity was 1 percentage point. You picked up a little less than 14 percentage points. John picked up a little less than 13 percentage points. It's practically a statistical error. However, technically, Professor Singh, you win the Tootsie Roll.